This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair OMFIF, welcoming you to a podcast on Federal Reserve monetary policy after the September 18th FOMC meeting. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Don Cohn and Bill Papadakis. As I'm sure the audience knows, Don worked for four decades at the Fed, heading up monetary policy division and serving as vice chair, including during the key crisis years. He's now at the Brookings Institution and a member of the Bank of England's Financial Policy Council. On a personal note, I had the pleasure of working with Don during parts of my career, and he's one of America's greatest public servants and monetary policy gurus, and every bit a wonderful person to match. Bill joins us from Banque Lombard Odier in Geneva, where he's a global macroeconomic strategist, and he's written extensively about global monetary policy and foreign exchange issues. Welcome, Don and Bill. So as expected, the FOMC cut the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points. But the real question was how the FOMC and the Powell press conference would frame the outlook for the economy and monetary policy, dovishly, neutrally, hawkishly. The U.S. economy is slowing toward trend as expected, but real data underpinned by low unemployment and solid consumption are holding up quite nicely. On the other hand, monetary policy is forward-looking. Manufacturing, the little more than 10% of our economy, is declining. Trade wars are hurting investment. And the FOMC is talking about insurance against deterioration. So my first question is, how do you weigh those factors and assess the economic outlook? Bill, would you like to start?
Yes, of course. I'd be happy to start. It's a good question. In fact, if you think about what the Fed is dealing with today, there are multiple forces that it has to cope with. One of them is, as you rightly say, the fact that the U.S. economy is slowing down to trend. We have a fairly mature business cycle by now. Another one is that the economy has to cope with the trade shock and the global uncertainty that this comes with. And then last but not least is the fact that the late cycle conditions also mean that little by little inflation is getting closer to target. The Fed had the luxury of not having to worry too much about inflation earlier on and had the ability to turn its stance into a more patient one and then to provide some accommodation as a trade shock was taking a more significant toll in the economy. But after a couple of insurance cuts that we've already experienced, that question is much more balanced today. So I think given where we stand today, the risk of inflation is not immediate and the Fed can afford to provide a little bit more accommodation in order to bring the economy at a more even keel. But it's true that looking at the economy from a fairly global perspective, the risks of a slowdown are not adverse enough that would justify a whole easing cycle that takes rates much closer to zero. So right now, I think the balance of factors points to one or two additional more cuts. And then at that point, the Fed can pause.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that. Don, what are your thoughts on the economic situation and outlook? And then we can turn a little bit more specifically to the FOMC itself.
So I broadly agree with what Bill said. The economy in the U.S. is slowing, but it's slowing from above trend to closer to trend growth, as both of you said. We have, Bill cited, the trade war issues creating a lot of uncertainty for businesses who have cut back quite sharply on investment. In addition, we had quite a bit of fiscal stimulus last year, which is coming off. So it's not surprising that the economy is slowing, and it really needed to slow to a more sustainable pace. Some of the effects of the fiscal stimulus coming off and the trade war effects have been offset by the Fed's easing its pivot really from a tightening stance late last year to an easing stance this year. The economy has been supported by very strong consumer spending. The job market's good, wages are rising, income is rising. So I think it's got a firm under support, a foundation for continued growth going forward as long as job growth remains good. And while we had a little bit of slowing down last month, it's still averaging over a couple months, it's still good, and wages are rising somewhat faster. So I think the outlook is good, but there are, as Bill cited, downside risks. The trade war and how that could spread and how it might accelerate and what the effects will be on business investment is one thing. And whether the uncertainty created by the trade situation, the global situation more generally, will feed back on businesses' hiring decisions, which it hasn't so far, in addition to their capital decisions. So I think there are downside risks. And with inflation still below the Fed's target, the Fed could take some, could do that pivot early this year and could take some insurance out against further weakness. I guess I'm not quite as sure as Bill is that there'll be another couple of easings coming up. I do think the Fed is tilted in that direction. That is, the leadership of the Federal Reserve seems to be on the alert for potential that it would need to ease somewhat further. I think it's less clear to me that that's going to be needed.
Well, thank you. You've foreshadowed, both of you, my second question, but let me ask you if you wish to amplify on it. But it is how you read the FOMC. There seem to be significant splits in the FOMC, maybe not as big as in the ECB, but still significant. And that the committee took a pretty neutral view, and certainly Mr. Powell seemed to in his press conference, waiting to see how events unfold. Don mentioned that the market seemed to be scaling back their assessment of future rate cuts for now. So I guess two questions: what you're reading the FOMC and where it's headed, if you wish to amplify. I think both of you touched on that. And I'm intrigued, Don, by your usage of the term insurance, because I have a house, I insure it, I pay a premium, but I probably wouldn't want to pay double the premium to doubly insure my house. So when the Fed says they want insurance, I haven't felt they've communicated clearly insurance against what and how much. Anyway, I throw that out in case you had a thought or two on that for us.
Sure. You've raised some very good questions here. I think the first thing to say is it's not surprising that there's disagreement on the Federal Open Market Committee. These are difficult decisions. They're not really clean. Gee, the economy is really weakening. We got to ease policy. You're looking at risks. You're looking at the insurance factor, as you said, Mark. You're looking, trying to look forward and see what might be happening. So I guess I'm not surprised. And in fact, I think it's good that there are disagreements, and that last time there were dissents on both sides. One voter wanted to go further and two voters didn't want to ease at all. And I think that's a healthy situation. Your question about how much insurance do you need is a really hard one. Right now, they have some insurance already. So they, if you look at their forecasts of interest rates over the longer run, the median is around 2.5%, and they're actually 2.5 or a little higher, I think, for a lot of folks. So let's call it 2.5, and there they are below 2. So they've got close to 75 basis points of insurance in some sense. They've got interest rates below the what they think they'll be over the longer run. Now, the hard question is whether that's enough to take care of the downside risks from the uncertainty about further escalation of the trade tensions that both Bill and I have talked about. It's just really hard to know. This is not a situation where you can look at a bunch of past data and decide how much insurance you need, how big the downside risks are. You've kind of got to play it by ear as you go through. So I think there'll be data dependent, and going forward, more data dependent than they have been, because actually the data they've gotten since June has been, if anything, a little stronger than they were expecting, retail sales, industrial production, and things like that. So I think, but going forward, they'll have to be really pay close attention to see how much effect the trade uncertainty, global weakness is having, and make a judgment about whether they need to ease some more, either just to offset that uncertainty or to buy some insurance. I think the other thing to say is the insurance is cheaper when inflation is running below your target. So one of the things they're worried about is persistent inflation below the target affecting inflation expectations, making it even harder to get the target? So the decision to buy the additional insurance, I think, is reinforced by the behavior of inflation.
Bill, do you have any thoughts for us?
Yes, certainly. So I would start by echoing Don's statement about the so-called divisions within the committee. I would say that I think it's a healthy evolution, perhaps on both sides of the Atlantic, that both sides of the debate are heard and they don't necessarily always need to make for a unanimous decision. It makes for cleaner policy occasionally, and the fact that we have seen dissent from both sides of the table means that healthy debate is being held at the committee and is being held at public. So we've seen speeches and comments by central bankers amplifying on their views, and I think that's generally helpful. It gives market participants and all economic agents more information about the thought process that's taking place at the Fed. In terms of the earlier discussion about expectations going forward, perhaps in trying to amplify a little bit on my earlier answer, I think it's certainly fair to say that what happens from this stage onward looks like a much closer call than in the past, because the Fed has already acted and in a way has managed to ease financial conditions sufficiently to prevent near-term recession risks, or at least risks of a further abrupt slowdown. The reasons for which, on balance, I think some more easing coming from the Fed looks likely is factors that we alluded to earlier, pockets of the economy that look vulnerable, especially given the ongoing trade tensions that, in our view, seem somewhat unlikely to be resolved very soon. Looking at the manufacturing sector of the economy, one can argue that it's near recession territory, given that business investment has been on the weak side of things and it's a rate-sensitive sector of the economy. A little bit more easing would be helpful. And at the same time, I think the Fed is cognizant of the fact that unlike previous global slowdowns where there was much more room for policy response elsewhere, this is no longer the case today. And although we've seen a wave of easing from other central banks in both the developed world and in emerging markets, that room for action isn't really that significant, and there's always the risk that no matter how much they try, they might not have a very substantial effect. By contrast, the Fed still has a little bit more room to act and in its function and sometimes in setting not only monetary conditions in the US, but affecting monetary conditions globally. Perhaps given the current circumstances, that would be an additional argument in favor of taking some additional insurance at this stage. Of course, I think it's fair to say that given the relative strength of recent data releases, it makes sense for the Fed to be increasingly data dependent. There was the luxury earlier this year of perhaps looking through some data and taking the so-called insurance anyway, because inflation was running low and the fear of the drag from trade were being significantly more impactful, pushed towards that direction. Today, we've moved a little bit further from that stage. So watching data closely, I think, is necessary. But still looking at the global picture, the Fed might tend towards a little bit more acting towards the end of this year.
Well, thank you. I have one observation on something that both of you said. It's just a personal one. Just that you both said that debate in the committee is good, and I totally agree with that. I do worry, given some of the president's attacks on the Fed's independence, that it would be ideal to have a completely unified Fed board. But debate is healthy, as you said. Since Bill was just raising international issues, let me ask an international question, and then I'll probably throw out a macroprudential question after that. But on the international side, Mark Carney gave this speech at Jackson Hole, and it basically suggested to me that the Fed should be more globally minded in its monetary policy reaction function. So the Fed is America's central bank. It's not a global lender of last resort. It has a dual mandate. It takes international spillbacks into account in so doing. But of course, the Fed impacts the world and vice versa. And Chairman Powell has recently cited the international developments and the president's ill-advised trade wars as a risk to the U.S. economy and mentioned this as a rationale for the insurance. So do you feel that the Fed needs to be more global or globally minded in formulating its monetary policy, and how might it do that? Don?
So, Mark, first of all, I think Mark Carney's speech, that wasn't the main thrust of Mark Carney's speech. So he might have felt like on the margin, the Fed needed to be a little more aware of the interconnections. And the Fed already is, as you just said, and as I think he said in the speech, it's been a little while since I read it, but the Fed already takes account of the spillovers and spillbacks. I think he was arguing that with the help of the IMF, all central banks needed to be more conscious of these spillbacks and spillovers. But he also acknowledged, if I remember correctly, that the central banks have domestic targets, maximum employment, stable prices in the case of the Fed, or stable prices in the case of the ECB, and that ultimately that domestic target is what is going to guide their actions. So I think the Fed is very well aware. I mean, obviously, in the whole discussion of easing of policy in 2019 has revolved around the effect of global slowdowns, trade tensions on the U.S. So the Fed's very aware of it. I think, interestingly, Carney's speech was aimed mostly at the domination of the dollar in global trade and medium of exchange and a pricing mechanism and the problems that was creating, especially for emerging market economies, and the effect of the fact that the Fed's actions and anything that happened in the U.S. had outsized effects on other countries, much more than the actions of the ECB or even the People's Bank of China or certainly the Bank of Japan. Wasn't so much that the Fed needed to take account of that, but that something needed to be done to mitigate that. He had a medium-term suggestion, which was to better increase the resources to the IMF and have the IMF act more as a lender of last resort for the economy so that other countries other than the U.S. didn't need to accumulate these insurance pots. And then ultimately, he was advocating for some sort of a mixed currency that would be the unit of account, not just the dollar. And that would, in his view, reduce some of the tail risk and some of the skews to risk in the global economy. It would be less dependent upon one particular country, and that would have positive effects on interest rates and on economic performance. So I think the part that you pointed out was a small part of a much broader thesis that I thought was very interesting. I'm not totally convinced that it could happen, but I thought he raised a number of very fascinating issues that should be the subject or could be the subject of global discussions.
Yeah, I think I agree pretty much with everything that you said. And having sat through IMF board deliberations for years and discussions about Fed impact on others, I was curious. Bill, do you have any thoughts for us on this one?
Sure. I don't have a particularly different view than Don's on this matter, but perhaps an additional element that I would like to include in the discussion is that currently U.S. Treasury bonds is the one safe asset where you can really get some yield as an investor looking around the world, be that in the euro area or in Japan, for investors who are looking to de-risk given rising risks globally. There isn't a lot of yield to be had. And in fact, in many of these cases, you make a guaranteed loss by buying government bonds. As a result, I would say that this poses an additional risk of dollar appreciation if such additional flows were to materialize towards the treasury market. And if that were to happen, we all know, and the Fed is, of course, aware that the dollar is a key element of the global financial infrastructure, but also is very significant in the effect that it has in the U.S. economy, coming at a time where it has appreciated significantly over the past few years on the back of monetary policy divergence between the U.S. and basically any other advanced economy. And given that the manufacturing sector is currently under pressure from a few angles, it's an element that inevitably has to feed back into the considerations of the FOMC. It is both a global factor and a domestic factor, but given that the environment has changed so drastically, at least in fixed income space, where it has the potential of creating additional flows that in previous cycles weren't necessarily as big an element, I think it's certainly something that needs to be considered, and the Fed has no alternative rather than to be very careful and very cognizant of the global conditions and how they fit back into the U.S. economy.
Thank you. I want to turn to Don. I'm taking advantage of your unique perspectives on monetary policy, but also on macroprudential regulation, given your role on the Financial Policy Council. And in part, I'm motivated in asking this question by discussions I've had with Steve Chiketty, and I've seen that the Boston Fed President Rosengren has raised similar issues. Financial conditions in the U.S. are highly accommodative. If you look at the Chicago Financial Conditions Index, for example, we know financial market froth can build up in such circumstances. We probably agree that macroprudential regulation and policy should be the first line of defense against such froth. But they're still in an evolutionary state. Monetary policy should achieve central bank mandates, but central banks have responsibilities for financial stability too. So is there a role for monetary policy to lean against the wind of financial exuberance or highly accommodative conditions, especially as macroprudential policies are still evolving?
So I would use monetary policy for macroprudential purposes to lean against the financial cycle only as a last resort. I think that monetary policy is not well suited for that sort of thing. There are very substantial costs to leaning against the wind. You have a higher unemployment rate. You're undershoot your inflation target, at least in the near and medium term, whether somewhat higher interest rates would really be effective at damping a financial cycle that was well underway, I think I have some skepticism about. So I don't rule it out. If you tried everything else and you have something that's really a threat to the future growth and welfare of the society, then yeah, you should be thinking about tightening monetary policy to deal with the financial stability threat. But I think in the U.S. in particular, there's much more that can and should be done with macroprudential policy. I think here the burden on monetary policy is potentially larger than it should be. So I think the U.S. needs to develop its macroprudential tools, which are very well developed for banks and especially for systemically important banks after Dodd-Frank and Basel III. They've largely dealt with too big to fail. The banking system is much safer. It's harder to say outside the banking system whether that's safe. So I think the U.S. needs to give serious consideration about whether it needs some housing tools to lean against housing cycles. After all, those were the cause of the 2008 financial crisis and also the problems in the early 90s. I think need to think carefully about whether problems are developing outside the banking system, who's holding those leveraged loan investment funds, mutual funds, the potential for runs on those and fire sales. I think it's important to take the pressure off of monetary policy by doing a better job of developing macroprudential tools in the U.S.
Thank you, Bill. Any comments?
I broadly agree with this view. I think we have to acknowledge how blunt the two monetary policies. I would say that it does make sense at the conceptual level, at least, for that tool to be on the table in case we have such broad excesses that need to be dealt with, and there's no other solution among the tools that have been tried. But I would also draw some attention to the fact that we do all suffer from a certain amount of trauma from the real estate collapse and the financial crisis that ensued over a decade ago now. So we tend to often think in similar terms, but looking at the US financial system today, I think the excesses are more isolated where they exist. Issues like leverage loans or perhaps financial innovation space, etc. And I'm not that sure that monetary policy would be particularly well suited to deal with them, at least from today's perspective. I somehow fail to see an immediate need.
Well, thank you. Great wisdom from both of you on that topic. Thank you for joining us on this podcast. I think everybody in our audience will learn tremendously from your valuable insights. So thank you, Don Cohn and Bill Papadakis.